like to call for the meeting of the legislation committee, which was scheduled for 1:30, and we're starting 10 minutes late, which isn't too bad.
Good for this board.
We awaited the arrival of Legislator Mezana. We have two.
And
Abenaki, the majority and minority leader. We need their presence.
Thank you, sir.
They have so much to offer us.
I don't know about that, but we're happy to be here.
Jim, could you pass that down, please?
Sure, Tom.
So we have two items on the agenda, two substantive items. One is carryover on source of income. And the second item is a continued discussion on the proposed legislation to regarding the use of eminent domain by the County of Westchester. So we'd like to do the eminent source of income first, because this is obviously a matter that has received exhaustive attention from this committee, from this board, from interested parties over the course of 2 years. And we had another public hearing the other night with approximately 26 speakers, 26 exactly, where we heard many of the same issues. I would like to say repeated, but there was some interesting comments that were maybe somewhat new. But the main reason that I recommitted it to this committee was at the request of Legislator Mezana, who wanted to make a proposed amendment to the proposed legislation. So I will yield the floor to Legislator.
That quick? Right over to me. Well, I have two thoughts, if I may. One that you and I have discussed, and one that we partially discussed. One we fully discussed, and one we partially discussed. So let me put them out so we can get everybody's input. The one change that we had discussed, even going into the public hearing, which then Nona and myself and others here at the board, was that since there is a debate here, I think a fair debate on both sides, you know, how deep is this problem that we need this legislation, that maybe that we may have this law have a sunset clause so that we can see how it works over a period of time and evaluate whether it needs to be continued. So I discussed with the chairman of the board and the chairman of the committee a 5-year sunset clause so that we can take a look after 5 years of the results of this law, how many cases were actually brought, what type of cases were brought, what was the disposition of the cases. And I think there was an idea that that's an idea we could support. So that's the first thing I put out, a 5-year sunset clause.
And that's in the proposed legislation that was distributed for today's meeting.
Oh, it is?
Yeah. If you look at it's the last page, section 6, paragraph B. At the last sentence. So that proposed amendment has been made.
Okay.
Before we discuss that, we'll go on to your second point.
My second thought was one of the things we heard from a lot of the speakers, and maybe we need more clarification from our attorneys on this. Hopefully the county attorney's office is here, are they?
Yes.
We heard from a lot of, many of the people that were opposed to the law kept raising the issue, $100,000 fines, $100,000 fine, $100,000 fines. And I don't think it's that simple. The $100,000, Peter Harkin was, and I were talking in the hallway the other day, it's not that simple, $100,000 fines. But I think I would just like to understand that issue a little better, how the fines actually work. And is there any way we could put some kind of cap on the fines if the board or this committee deems that that's appropriate and that we don't want the fines to go up to $100,000 or $50,000, whatever the number is. But that's something I briefly mentioned to you, Mr. Chair, and it's something I think it's worth at least a little discussion.
We looked at the law, and the $100,000 fine applies if an action that's violative of the act is willful, wanton, or malicious. So it's not an open-ended cap. I mean, it's not an open-ended cap in the sense that someone violates the law, they can be fined that much.
It is not only not that reason, it is not a mandatory number, it is an up-to number. Mm-hmm. And it only kicks in the willful and deliberate category. And I think it would be appropriate to take testimony from the representatives of the Human Rights Commission, which is where this number comes from.
I don't think we have any representatives here, do we? We have the county attorney. Would you like to comment on the penalties and what they are and when they're applicable?
Well, as the law states, it's upon willful and wanton behavior, but these penalties were just recently amended by the board, I think maybe 2 years ago, and the executive director of the Human Rights Commission, when the Fair Housing Law was passed, indicated that, you know, some of these penalties are applicable in New York City, and even in the state have similar penalty provisions. So it was applicable for fair housing violations, and this board thought it was best to amend the law and to increase the potential penalties.
Can you describe them all? Describe the different tiers of the penalties. I know we know we have one that's wanton and willful. What's the lower one?
Wanton is so
cheap.
I really do like Chinese food.
Thank you, folks. She's here all week.
The tough crowd.
Charter with me, which has all of the different penalties.
You sure it's 100? Because I know somebody testified, a couple of people said there was nothing on $100,000 in the
it's
city.
It's $100,000
if it's willful and wanton.
What about New York City?
They said New York City didn't have that. That's what I heard
New York,
the testimony.
No, New York City was $100,000. That's why we matched up to New York City. Mr. Chairman, we did match up to that. Can we have someone staff and just pull over the Human Rights Commission and have one of them?
It's
a good idea.
Just call over the Human Rights Commission.
You want to? The question is whether New York City has that penalty.
But somebody testified and said, "Where did we get 100? New York City doesn't even have 100 now. One or two people testified.
I'm sorry, I do have it with me. We got it
from New York City. That was
right. That's what you said.
In the Fair Housing Law, under Section 700.29,
B,
Orders and Awards, and it authorizes the Fair Housing Board to award compensatory damages, punitive damages, not to exceed $10,000, okay, to a person of need. Then there's a civil penalty and an amount not to exceed $50,000 to be paid to the County of Westchester by a respondent found to have committed an unlawful discriminatory real estate practice. So that's a potential penalty in addition to compensatory damages.
Which is $10,000. Up to $10,000.
Compensatory is just compensatory. So there's that's compensatory. Then there's punitive damages
unlimited.
Up to $10,000, not to exceed $10,000. Then you have a civil penalty, potentially, not to exceed $50,000, and that would be paid to the county, or not to exceed $100,000, again to be paid to the county, if the respondent is found to have committed an unlawful discriminatory real estate practice, which is found to be willful, wanton, and malicious. So we have potential for compensatory damages, punitive damages, and civil penalties. Okay, civil penalties, $50,000 or $100,000. So that's in the law. And that was recently.
Could you read that again?
Could you read the section dealing with 100 one more time?
This is the exact language. The commission can quote.
Are you looking? Where?
700.29B. No, but I'll read it to you and you can look at it.
Okay.
Assessing a civil penalty in amount not to exceed $50,000 to be paid to the County of Westchester by a respondent found to have committed an unlawful discriminatory real estate practice, or not to exceed $100,000, to be paid to the County of Westchester by a respondent found to have committed an unlawful discriminatory real estate practice, which is found to be willful, wanton, or malicious.
Willful?
Wanton. Wanton or malicious.
So that if it's willful, it doesn't have to be wanton and malicious, it just has to be willful. So willful means intentionally telling a person no.
Yeah. It's a little unclear. You know,
so that means if you intentionally say, I'm not taking you because you have Section 8, you violated that section and subject yourself to a $100,000 penalty.
Up to, not mandatory.
No, I understand that, but it's still.
And the person
just willful.
Who makes that decision is the
Human Rights
Commission.
Do we know how they decide whether they're going to just give compensatory or they're going to do punitive. Well, are there standards how they make these decisions about the civil penalty versus compensatory?
None in the statute.
Do whatever they want.
That the punitive damages standard is also
that.
Willful, wanton.
Put that aside.
For $10,000.
I'm saying $50,000 on down. So you have the $50,000 civil penalty, compensatory damages, and punies of $10,000. What is there any standards for any of that?
Willful, wanton, or malicious for the punitive.
For the punitive. Okay.
No,
compensatory.
No.
Read the statute. 700.29(b)(1)(d) allows the commission to award punitive damages against a respondent found to have committed an unlawful discriminatory real estate practice, which is found to be willful, wanton, or malicious in an amount not to exceed $10,000 to the person aggrieved by such practice. So it has to be willful, wanton, or malicious, and the person who brought the claim gets the $10,000. Subdivision F is a civil penalty that goes to Westchester. If it's $50,000, it's $50,000 up to $50,000 for an unlawful discriminatory practice, and up to $100,000 for willful, wanton, or malicious. So someone could conceivably be found to have committed a willful or a wanton or a malicious discriminatory real estate practice and be required to pay up to $10,000 to the person who was the complainant and $100,000 to the county.
And compensatory.
Yeah.
And with no standards. It just says wanton. What's wanton mean?
Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Dolores is up.
Okay.
While we save those questions for us.
Well, but the statute doesn't provide any. This is up to the interpretation of the, right?
Well, I mean, there is case law interpreting those words.
Those words.
I haven't looked at it recently.
Wanton is not
willful,
real.
Willful, wanton, or malicious.
There's a lot of case law.
You see that those terms used in a lot of statutes. Compensatory damages has a limit because it's compensatory.
Willful is very easy to show because the only thing less than willful is negligent.
Yeah.
So if the person says...
Well, let's ask the...
Even if they're unaware of the statute, they willfully...
When she gets here, what the...
It's willful conduct, not willful... It's willful conduct, not willful... But the statute... I mean, these are not necessarily going to be the same people forever. The statute says willful conduct. It's not willful violation of the statute, correct? It's willful conduct, not willful violation of the statute.
Unlawful discriminatory practice by a respondent found to have committed an unlawful discriminatory real estate practice, which is found to be willful wanton.
Right, so it's not necessarily a willful... Practice. Right, so it's not a willful violation of the statute, it's willful conduct.
Willful practice.
It's a practice.
Right.
Just very brief, we'll focus on the $100,000.
Let me put it in the simpler situation. Now, this is the discussion we have in real estate contracts all the time. You know, you lose the money if you willfully don't close. So willfully not closing means don't come to the closing. For whatever reason, you're not coming to the closing. It's not a willful violation of the contract. So I'm just saying this is a situation where I'm used to the word willful. I always try to get the word willful out because my client could get hit by a car and decide he'd rather go to the doctor rather than the closing. So that's a willful determination not to go to the closing. So you try to change that language. Now you've got the same situation here, where it's willful conduct, no requirement that they even know there's a statute requiring this conduct. It's just willful conduct.
Well, I'm not sure about that.
Well, that's why I asked you, is it willful violation of the statute? The language you read to me is willful conduct.
Yeah,
not willful violation.
If it's an unlawful discriminatory real estate practice, to be willful, I think you have to prove scienter, that there's knowledge of being, that it's unlawful.
That's not what I'm hearing there.
Well, I think
it's not a criminal statute, it's a civil statute.
I would bet you that's the way it's interpreted.
Well, and also, what's the burden of proof? The burden of proof is preponderance of evidence?
Of the civil
case,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
let's just focus on the $100,000. How about, I heard up to $50,000.
That alone is...
Seems with just, you know, the small landlords, $50,000 is the same as $100,000. But the $50,000, up to $50,000, it just seems like a violation. Right? I mean, we're all focused on that.
You don't have to be willful.
Right, so that's, I mean, to me, that's...
Up to.
But I'm saying the standards for being subject to up to 50 is just...
That means you got to hire a lawyer. You got to go in fully prepared.
Right. Don't focus on the $100,000. Focus on up to $50,000.
This is not just you walk in and pay a parking ticket.
Well, an interesting thing about that section is Section F, which has these civil penalties. They're not really
benefiting the complainant. They're not benefiting the person who was discriminated against. It's kind of like a bounty for the county.
Jim?
So I think it's worth thinking about this a little more.
Well, is that to basically pay for the Human Rights Commission? The work?
Mr. Chairman, I would just say, why don't we wait until
Can I just add one thought? I agree with Ken. You know, I remember when we had debate in fair housing, and I frankly was never overly comfortable with the civil penalty. It did seem a little overbroad and a little bit too loose. There's no standard for it. As you said, it's almost like just a bounty to the government. No one complains. No one bats an eye here on compensatory damages to the aggrieved party. Right, nobody bats an eyelash. And nobody here bats an eyelash about punitive damages for particularly egregious conduct by a particular violator. But I do think there's probably some people wondering here why this civil penalty is so big and has no standards. So I don't know if we have to, you know, maybe we could continue to talk about it right now, but this definitely needs to be examined for the entire Human Rights Code.
Well, if I may, there may be a standard. We just don't know it yet. So let's not say
Meanwhile, let's come back and have some discussion. We haven't had any discussion because we went to both of your issues. Let's come back and talk about the Sunset Clause and find out if there's any comment on that.
Do you want to wait? You have guesses on the other statute. Do you want to do that one first?
We get to Dolores. We could talk about the Sunset Provision.
I'm just saying because you have people here on the...
We're running on a tight time scale.
He's a good chairman.
On the sunset provision, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the efforts of my colleague here looking for a compromise, but it seems to me, with all due respect to my friend here, focusing on a sunset as some kind of, you know, way to work this through does not take into account any real understanding of the real estate law in Westchester County. Landlords live under ETPA, and ETPA is not sunset. After 5 years, whatever's going on in those buildings is there, and if we determine, oh, geez, this law is really not working, well, the good news is it's sunset. Well, for all those landlords who have people in their apartments, it's not sunset. So the sunsetting of this law really has no impact.
No, but what he's saying is, first of all, I'm against the legislation.
Yeah, well, but I'm just saying.
But I think Jim is saying, if the sunset, if we don't renew it after 5 years, then there won't be any source of income law.
Can't bring it
well, for a few, but anybody, any landlord who's taken Section 8, really didn't want to, but under the law for the first 5 years, took Section 8 tenants
in. They'll be obligated for only those 5 years.
No, that's my point. ETPA is not sunset. ETPA is what, once that tenant is in that building, under the current case law, which even Dennis Enright pointed, yes, that's true, ETPA goes on and on and on.
I agree.
Saying to the effort to...
So does Section 8.
The bigger picture, but we would only presumably stop it after 5 years if we found problems with it. I mean, if it was working, then we would keep going. We find problems, we want to stop it. Well, it's just those problems you're not going to be able to affect in all those ETPA buildings. Just saying it's of some benefit because it will stop the implement. So I just... It doesn't get to that issue.
If a tenant is in an ETP,
and then the next tenant, once those ETP buildings, then it just stays. So it just doesn't sunset.
No, well,
it doesn't.
Can't really put it in sunset.
People stay in the units.
And it'll affect all those, you know, non ETPA, and the law would go away. Assuming we didn't renew it, the law would go away. But whether there's 2 or 20 or 200 tenants in ETPA buildings. Those buildings, ETPA goes to the building. That tenant leaves, another Section 8 tenant can come in. So I'm just saying, that's my understanding of ETPA.
Well, let me explain my understanding.
All right.
We'll see, maybe we're not disagreeing.
Yeah, okay.
If the law sunset is in 5 years, any Section 8 ETPA tenant would still be entitled to have their lease renewed.
Well, under ETPA, just generally, right.
But the Rosario case says that if it's a Section 8 ETPA tenant, they'll have to have their lease renewed. But if a ETPA Section 8 tenant leaves and a law sunset and a new person comes in, the
ETPA law says it has to be Section, not this law. This law is gone. This law is sunset.
No, but the ETPA doesn't deal with Section 8. It's the case law. It's one case in the Court of Appeals that says if it's an ETPA tenant and they're a Section 8 tenant, they're entitled to have their lease renewed under Section 8 terms. So if you have the law sunsets, 5 years, day two, ETPA Section 8 tenant moves out,
a new person comes to that apartment, it's an ETPA apartment, it's a Section 8 tenant, the landlord would not have to accept
I don't.
Because the laws
that was my understanding, too.
The Section 8 laws, our Section 8 mandatory requirement to accept a Section 8 tenant has expired.
Yeah, but you can't put the tenant out under
exactly. No, he's saying if
it's a new tenant.
What is an open unit? You're not under the source of income.
I think you're under ETPA laws. You're not under this law. Now you're under ETPA laws.
But ETPA doesn't require you to accept the tenant.
From the next tenant?
With a potential
tenant?
But once
it's a Section 8
tenant. Who's the tenant?
Once it's a Section 8
tenant. Who's the tenant? Is it the individual or is it Section 8?
The Section 8 attaches to that apartment. That's my understanding.
Let's
not debate. Let's get an answer.
Oh, no, we need to debate. It's an interesting question. I agreed with John's analysis. If you think John's wrong, this is an important question. We've got to figure it out.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have another person who'd like to answer the question, but Peter, you're first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Normally I'm not a fan of sunsets in laws because it... You know, I kind of feel like, well, maybe we didn't get it right the first time. But this has been such a contentious issue, and I'd love to see some closure in a positive way. I'd love to see this pass with several more votes on board to really give it the moral stature that it deserves rather than passing by one vote, for instance. So Jim, that's why I agreed with Jim on this. I would do a sunset on this. My suggestion would be, it's going to take us nearly a year to get up to speed. And then we're going to, that last year, we're going to be looking at stuff, you know, trying to review. That's really only 3 years of data. If you would make it a six-year sunset, then we'd get between like 4.5, we'd have like 4.5 years worth of data. Then we could really make a decision based on several years of data. So, you know, my friendly suggestion would be to go to 6 years, but I would support it as a compromise.
I was going to say 1 year, and let's see how it works.
No, you're not going to be up to speed. You're not going to know anything. You know, the people who are against it are still going to be against it.
You're first, okay. And then, Dorothy, yeah.
I understand the amount.
Okay.
Just about the amount of the length of the bill being in effect before it sunsets, we do have in the law already in Section 6 a provision such that only tenants who are in place already have the law take effect immediately. For everybody else, applicants to new apartments, it takes effect after 6 months.
Right.
So if we're going to have a sunset clause,
it should start after the 6 months.
It should be 5 full years for everybody.
It should be after the 6 months.
If we're going to have a 5-year sunset clause. Otherwise, there's not enough time.
Exactly.
So instead of saying 5 years from its enactment, you should say 5 years from its effective date?
Correct.
Did you check that?
Well, it's effective immediately for some tenants, those who are already existing, and for new tenants, it's 6 months, thereafter. So we can work the language, but it's...
Well, it should start after the 6 months.
After the 6 months.
Yeah, I agree, Karen. Would you be open to that, Jim?
Yes.
Dorothy Finger.
Hi, Dorothy.
If I might, a couple of things. First of all, in less than 10 minutes here, we've gone from looking at sunset and briefly discussing whether it might be a good thing or not to, okay, we're going to play with the time frame of it. And I think the brevity of this debate is what's wrong here. We've already raised an issue of ETPA. I think Mr. Radowski's analysis is probably correct, but if it's not, there are other factors that also extend the application. Under the federal laws, if you have one Section 8 tenant, you have to pay Section 8. So, there have been cases all over the place, but that has always been an issue and a problem. So we're going to build in, tenants with Section 8, and then if this board should decide, well, it's really not enough happening there and the law isn't really doing anything, we're going to sunset it. We don't know how that's going to be interpreted, either on the ETPA, which has said that once, they haven't talked about, I don't believe, just in terms of a particular tenant. They said once it's in leases, you can't not renew it. So the application as to what goes with that apartment is an ETPA apartment. It's not here. And unless somebody gets an opinion from the Division of Housing that clearly addresses
I'm not sure
the
issue, I think
you don't know exactly what's going to happen.
All right.
So that's the ETPA issue.
Well, we've discussed the ETPA issue in the prior meeting in great detail,
right,
including the import of the Rosario case.
Right, but not in terms of a sunset.
Yeah, and that's what we're discussing now.
Right.
Right, and I'm pretty sure I'm right, Mr. Rogowski, you're wrong, by the way.
John, I'm pretty sure you're wrong.
What is
but this law was not this law was not in place when those decisions came. So you can have a lot of arguments about this law, whether and if this is something. So that's one issue. I think more work and more opinions have to be gotten from the agencies that really deal on a day-to-day basis with these leases.
Well, what opinions do you think we need to get?
I think from the Division of Housing.
And what do we? What should
well,
we ask them? How would you frame the question?
Two things. Three things. One is, what in fact would be the opinion as to whether or not, if a tenant moves out, Section 8 tenant moves out, whether the landlord is required under the ETPA for that apartment to also take possession of the tenant? That would be one. The other would be, if the landlord has not previously taken possession.
Please listen. Start again. I'm sorry.
Second would be, landlord has not previously taken Section 8, takes Section 8, but then because of this legislation, and then this legislation terminates, would they still have to take Section 8 tenants in that building under either the Division of Housing or from the federal law system? Section 8. So they ask the Section 8.
Okay, and what's the third question?
I'll leave it at the two.
Okay, well, the second question, if there was no previous Section 8 tenant, and a landlord took a Section 8 tenant, and then the law expired, are you assuming that Section 8 tenant was there already?
Was what?
Well, let me back up.
John, the answer is yes.
Can Marty just explain?
No, no. All right? I'm having a discussion, and then you'll have your turn. Okay. I want to clarify this, okay? So please don't
trying
interrupt.
To clarify.
Don't interrupt, and you'll get your full time.
Okay.
If there's no previous Section 8 tenant and the landlord takes Section 8, and then this law expires, your question is, would they still need to take a Section 8? Let's assume we never enacted our law. Under those circumstances, would a landlord who's taken a Section 8 tenant would be required to take the Section 8 tenant?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So our law has absolutely no effect on the landlord's obligation.
Well, unless, no, but
it's the landlord's decision.
It's the ones who did that are only taking it because of our law.
It's a voluntary decision.
No. Because he takes a Section 8 tenant because our law requires
right.
it.
Right. Exactly.
We don't have
exactly.
to now.
John, so, Marty just said something that wasn't said loudly that helped us.
Our law does not require them to.
We're not requiring something. Anybody
what,
to do anything.
No, wait a second. What he's saying is Marty just said, I asked him, I said, explain to me what you're saying. And I think it helps the conversation here. And that is, certain services come with Section 8. ETPA requires that once you reach a certain level of services, you can't back down on those services for the building. So if the landlord does something, because he's required to do it, or she's required to do it by Section 8, cannot now, once he loses the Section 8 tenant, back off from those services.
What services are you
It might be
about?
The language in a lease. It might be that Section 8 comes in and says, we want lights outside of the building. And he says, I don't think we need lights. Well, I want lights because you're going to take it for this tenant. So he puts the lights in. The ETPA tenant leaves. There's no longer an inspection of the building. Tries to take the lights out. Now the tenants can say, nope, you can't take it away. It's a service that you gave to the building.
Well, if it's in the lease.
But no, it would only be in that one Section 8 lease.
It's very complicated. Tom, if I might.
Am I correct on that?
I think it's a correct analogy. But I think the problem is we're trying to answer the question. And we cannot. That's why I'm saying we need to go to these agencies to get very clear questions, draft up a bunch of scenarios, and get answers as opinions as to what will happen.
Well, I think you pretty much answered number two, that if...
Well, I've answered, but they shouldn't take my word.
I think I will. I mean, I think I understand the import. If our law required a landlord to take Section 8, then our law expires, and under federal law, because a landlord has a Section 8 tenant, that landlord is required to take subsequent Section 8 tenant under federal law.
Thank you.
Got the first. I understand that. I think you're right.
Mr. Chairman.
What's your
Mr. Chairman.
Wasn't that part of the law and was in English repealed? Wait a second. One at a time. I think that was repealed. All right, we'll check on that.
Mr. Chairman,
but the other thing, just to
Yeah, go ahead. I want to give you a full chance.
My other comment is, as I said, it's getting very contentious, but the issue is the broad issue. As I said, we're trying, a short period of time now, to suddenly find a resolution, and I appreciate that. I mean, I understand sometimes that's a mean impression. But if we have to go back to some of the initial objections, and the whole thing with sunset concept, to me, one of the major problems is that if you're doing it because you really have reservations about it anyway, and you don't think it's a good law, but now political pressure or the fact that you've been kicking it around for X amount of years and people are getting worn down and tired and you want to get it off the agenda, a sunset is an easy way to get a compromise. The problem is if it's not good to start with, if the gloves don't fit, you got to quit. If the law is not basically the law that, as in the form that you really want, that really is going to accomplish what you want, which I don't believe this will, because we've talked about this before, the units in the areas, there are no units in the areas that you really want to make headway. It's not going to expand affordable housing north of White Plains. It's just not happening, especially in this market. In the next 5 years, there's not going to be some magic, eruption of Section 8 or other units for affordable housing in that part of the county. So this is not going to change that. You may smack one or two small landlords. You may get, maybe there's some big landlord that somehow most of them don't really care in those types of housing. But the major thing is not going to happen. And in the southern part of the county, we know that the vouchers are being used. People are getting housing. So I think, there may be some other issues, but until the law really addresses the problem directly, the means and the ends, like the Constitution says, until it really does that, the sunset is not the way to answer the question. It should be deal with the legislation, do something that makes it right, and thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. And we have heard that, we have appreciated the argument made before regarding where in the county it's going to have an effect. And I do have to say, we're not rushing this through. This has been discussed for 2 years. There are a number of us that think that this, the sunset is a recent development. A number of us think this is a good law, and we're trying to actually accommodate many of the concerns that the landlords have raised. And that is what has taken us a long time, to try to listen to those concerns and try to accommodate them. And there's a certain point we can go where if you accommodate them anymore, the law will have absolutely no teeth. So the sunset provision was actually, I thought, a reasonable effort to try to at least examine the law in 5 years and see, whether it's working or not working, understanding that it would have an effect on existing tenants, some of them. Mr. Abenaki, I promised him the floor before.
I just wanted to clarify that I have some other issues, so if you want to continue on this discussion.
I just think it's a
suggestion. But I think there's an important issue
there. I just think a suggestion, then you can get into your more substantive review.
Right.
Mine's more procedural. What do we decide to do today with this? Put aside. We vote on it, we don't vote on it. Put that aside for a second. Nothing stops us, right, from at least having our county attorneys do some of the research on these issues they're posed in the next week before next Monday. Because next Monday, all we're going to do is vote it out again for a public hearing. Yeah. The process is going. So whatever we do today, any question anyone in this room raises, let's ask our county attorneys to roll up their sleeves and get us a good legal opinion.
Right. Okay.
Just on this point, because there was a question about the Section 8 on taking a tenant, I believe that there is accuracy on the statement for project-based Section 8. That's what. So there is, if there is a building that received money from the federal government to make improvements, and in return for that, they had project-based Section 8.
It stays with the apartment. So this law wouldn't affect that.
This law would not affect that, and that is, I just wanted to clarify that. And thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm just going to suggest, because we asked Scott Brathwaite to come up, and Josh, they were in a meeting with the county attorney, and we pulled them out of that to come up here, so if we could, to take a time out and then come back to the discussion.
Okay.
All right, the points that I was going to make, if I can, very briefly.
Well, no, Kenny asked that we take them out of order, because they've got to go back to the county attorney, and then we'll come to your points.
Okay.
Okay, do you mind? Josh and Dolores, will you please have a seat? I guess the reason we asked you to come was an issue has been raised with respect to these the penalty provisions.
In particular, penalty provisions in the
human rights
law.
In the housing law, yeah, okay. The housing Where's law. That? Section 700.29 B, 1, D, and F. One provides for punitive damages for the complainant of an amount not to exceed $10,000, and one provides for a civil penalty to the county by a respondent who has committed an unlawful real estate practice of $50,000 or up to $100,000 if the respondent is found to have committed an unlawful discriminatory real estate practice which is found to be willful, wanton, or malicious. Mm-hmm. And I guess we're trying to get an idea of how you would interpret that provision. Mr. Abinanti raised an issue about whether it just has to be a willful practice or a willful act or a willful violation of the law, and how you interpret willful, wanton, or malicious.
Well, the first question is, have they in the past interpreted it yet?
Well, have you had to interpret it?
No, we have not. But I do want you to know that this is not a decision that the commission would make, but the administrative law judge assigned to hear the case. So that would be the determining factor based upon the evidence, because there would be a full evidentiary hearing that would make the determination with respect to the merits of the case, as well as to what the damages would be, and whether punitive damages should be assessed in that case. So that would be all be left to the
administration. And then is an appeal, who's the appeal go to? The board? The Human Rights Commission? Or
no,
the
but it goes
court?
To the Supreme Court's appeal.
No, wait a second.
Jim.
The chairman, right?
Yes.
My understanding is that you guys have to make the final determination.
We so order it.
But well, so the appeal is.
But you don't review the decision of the administrative law judge.
It's a recommended order, and then it gets so ordered. If it's acceptable, we so order it, and if there is an appeal from that, it goes to the Supreme Court.
Well, okay.
But what's your
John? Do you hear what she just said? Basically, what she's saying is the board does not exercise its responsibility to make an independent judgment on the basis of the recommendation of the hearing officer. My understanding of the statute
it
is.
Go to the board.
Well, let's clarify that.
Okay. Yeah.
Well,
what's the board's function?
Yeah, the board's function is to review any of the decisions that come in. And when I say that, Tom, I'm not meaning me personally. It is the board's decision, and they review it. They so order it. The chair of the board does, not me.
Let's understand. The statute says, if I'm understanding this correctly, is that there is a board determination. You choose. It may be in the statute for authorization, but you choose to select an independent hearing officer to make a recommendation.
Correct.
And so it's the ultimate determination of the board, not the determination of the hearing officer.
Well, the hearing officer has to do the findings and the determination.
Right. No, that's a recommendation from the hearing officer.
And it's a recommended order and decision.
Okay, fine. So, but it's still a determination by your board. So the question before you is, do you have any rules, regulations, or standards on the basis of which you would interpret the statute? Taking the answer so far is no.
I would say no. We don't have it. We have not had to exercise it. We have
There's
not
no
had
administrative law judge has ever found anybody to be guilty Correct. Of a willful, no. wanton, or malicious
Not
priority.
Today.
Now, just to clarify the review process, Section 700.29C says that final determinations by the board shall be subject to review by the commission upon any application by any party agreed by a final order. So what's that process? So
the final determination by the board.
Right. So
okay.
according to this, mm-hmm. Section 700.29B says, in the event that the board shall, after a hearing, determine that a respondent has committed an unlawful discriminatory practice, the following relief mm-hmm. is available. So the administrative law judge makes a recommendation to the board, right? And then the board issues an order, but then that order is appealable to the commission.
Yeah, I was going to say
before it goes to court.
I think what they're saying is that the commission should look at it before it gets appealed.
What's the difference between the board and the commission?
The board is made up of members of the commission, but who are appointed specifically for fair housing cases.
How many is that?
Five.
It's a fair housing board.
They make up the board. And there is a chair of that fair housing board.
And Ms. Chair, so then it goes to the full commission after that.
Right. If there is an issue or a problem.
Right. then you take an Article 78 proceeding of the commission.
Yes.
And the right. only question in an Article 78 proceeding is whether there was substantial evidence. So it's basically almost impossible to overturn unless it was totally out of line.
Yeah, but since there's a hearing, it would be substantial evidence.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right.
Dolores, if you could, can you give us some background information on the civil penalty piece that goes up to $50,000. Has it been used? Has anybody been hit with that yet?
No.
Well, since you know more about this than anybody here.
And if you remember, Legislator Maizano, when we were talking about it way back when, I think we looked at that as more of a deterrent rather than something that we wanted to put in. And obviously, you know, even in the human rights law itself, before we even bifurcated the housing piece from it, and it's basically analogous, both the human rights law and this one, in right. terms of the penalties. But it has operated more as a deterrent rather than something that has been utilized.
That's a great prelude to my question then. So, in your thinking, when do you think that will be considered? What type of case will cause the examiner to go into down the road of the civil penalty? It seems like it's kind of sitting out there. I'm not quite sure how one would decide to hit somebody with that. Do you have any thought about how when that may come up?
Well, I can't get into the head of
sure.
a possible administrative law judge or what have you, but I will say that it would more likely than not certainly have to be an egregious situation. A real egregious case of discrimination where there is just absolutely no other way to say it but that it was malicious or it was willful or it was wanted.
But that's not for the first 50,000, right? That's only up to 100,000, right?
Right.
Up to the 50,000, you don't need those other that egregious conduct.
Well, the thing is that, for instance, where was the one we just had? Decision we just came in and they assessed some civil penalties. And that was a case where the people were disabled. And the landlord just refused to put in a ramp. I mean, he said, if I knew you were disabled, we wouldn't even have let you come and move in here. I mean, there were just a lot of very real discriminatory pieces that were attached to this. And I think the judge felt, I think they assessed something like $10,000 in terms of penalties. And that was bad enough, but it certainly didn't meet the threshold as far as the judge was concerned to go the way 50,000 or 100,000.
But legislator
raised a good issue that what does willful mean? I mean, if someone, let's take this situation, if we pass the Section 8 source of income law and Section 8 tenant came and the landlord said, I'm not accepting you, you're a Section 8 tenant. That's willful right there, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
We had a case which I call benevolent discrimination, where a landlord refused to rent to an elderly couple because he saw the gentleman in a walker and said, you know, I work with the elderly and I'm really concerned about your ability to handle the stairs, so I don't want to rent to you because I don't want you to hurt yourself. That seems to me, and I'm not an ALJ, but that seems to me it's not willful, wanton, and malicious, as opposed to this case where the ALJ found the statement of, if I knew you were in a wheelchair, I never would have rented to you to be. So sometimes the discrimination is not necessarily malicious or willful. Sometimes it's inadvertent, but it's still discriminatory.
So that's $50,000.
That's $50,000.
Well, it may be. That's really up to the discretion of the ALJ.
Do you know where we got those numbers from, the 50 or the 100? We model them after another?
Those are up to.
Well,
you're acting like
$10,000 is a lot of money.
It's up to, and I think if I recall correctly, it's been a long time now, but if I recall correctly, we were looking at that and mirror the original human rights law. And those civil penalties and fines initially were taken from various counties in the state when they were putting, you know, the case putting it together. So when we bifurcated, we wanted to maintain some consistency. And so we used the same language from the human rights law to put into the human rights fair housing law, so that there would be consistency in terms of that.
Legislator Rogowski had a question.
Yeah, I think this is raising an interesting issue. I mean, Dolores made, I think, fair point, deterrence. You know, sometimes, you know, you put a big number out there, hoping that you never have to use it. And I think, so we're starting to mix apples and oranges. As far as the original intent of the Human Rights Commission and, you know, race, color, creed, religion, those things, I think it's probably, you know, it was a good thing. I certainly support it. And
because we don't certainly want that kind of discrimination, and you could throw a big number out there. And my understanding is, you know, of someone felt discriminated, they come to the commission, you provide legal counsel, the respondent needs to provide counsel. But for those human rights violations, I would say, fine. But in the real estate world, you know, there's a, again, this is the real world, to make my point. If I were to do a lease, commercial tenant, residential tenant, and leave out the phrase, you know, either prevailing party or, you know, some people responsible for their own attorney's fees. So on the commercial side, someone doesn't pay their rent, I have to take them to court, incur legal fees, and then they pay at the end. And then case over. You do month after month, and there comes harassment. And but that's, you know, we're not talking about non-payment. We're not talking about race, color, creed. So here, now that we're putting housing in the situation, I have to believe, with or without testing, the Section 8 issue will come up, and a landlord sitting there now, feeling, and maybe it's not willful, but for whatever the reasoning is, but they're looking at the deterrent penalties and saying, you know what, I may have a Section 8 tenant in front of me, a non-Section 8 tenant that came within 2 hours apart, but I see this deterrence, and they can get free legal counsel, and I can't. And I don't know if we're going to amend this law to say that, you know, the prevailing party or the losing party has to be. We want to protect people who felt discriminated against. So we did not put the burden in the current law on people to hire counsel. You provide the counsel for them. But this is now, because we're creating a different class of discrimination, now you do get in a situation where the small landlord or large landlord is going to say, you know, I can't afford the deterrent penalties, this hiring lawyers. To Ken's viewpoint, I am being forced by this law to take the Section 8 because that's the path of least resistance, because the so-called tenant is not going to have to get their own lawyer and make a decision, is this, you know, really discrimination? I got free legal, so nothing to me. I'll just make a phone call. I got the commission working for me, and the landlord has this legal problem, because in the real world, that's a real issue. That's a real issue. And we're taking away from race, gender, to this area, and because we're mixing now, again, I don't think we want to amend the law to say, you know, the complainant has to hire their own lawyer. I don't know, but that would even the grounds out, but we haven't done enough of this. So I just want to make that point. In the real world,
can I follow them?
So it's the deterrence that's going to require the landlord to say, I'd rather go with that tenant, but I got to go with the Section 8 because I'm being deterred with those penalties.
What's troubling me all along, and I've never had a good answer to this, is what happens where the landlord says, fine, I'll take you. I don't have a problem with your Section 8. Section 8 comes in and says, okay, you've got to make a modification to the building. I mean, that's what troubled me with this as well, because he takes a tenant, and now all of a sudden he's got to make a major modification to his building to accommodate this one particular tenant.
They have to pay for it, though.
Who has to pay for it?
Doesn't the tenant have to
be No. The issue is whether if it's a major modification, the landlord says, I don't want to have
it. Where is that?
It's a reasonable business judgment.
Well, it didn't work in this case.
Depending on $1,000, $5,000.
It didn't work in this case.
Because it's not, because a reasonable business judgment defense isn't in the rest of the fair housing law.
No, but the rest of the fair housing law applies. Section 8 person, who the landlord might not take because of Section 8, might have a disability.
You can pay $1,000 legal fees.
Sure, that applies. That discrimination on the basis of disability is a separate charge.
So you take the person, as Marty just said, he's got two tenants in front of him, both equal, one Section 8, one's not, is afraid to turn down the first one because of this deterrent, now all of a sudden gets into a whole series of things, and this whole series of modifications that Section 8 says they want. How does that person say no? They have a history that says...
It's a reasonable business judgment, that if he doesn't have to make the modifications. Yes.
Are there any standards on what's a reasonable business model?
I think it
that's going to have to be determined.
It's going to have to depend on the type of modification you're talking
depends
about.
Depends on the facts.
If you're, you know, it's a small modification, and there are modifications that if a tenant wants, that the tenant has to pay for. So we need to bear that in mind, too, that you can, that the landlord can say, that's fine, you can do it.
But if the entire apartment has to be redone to accommodate that person.
That's not a modification.
It's a question of refurbishing. It's a question of overhauling.
Josh, did you have a comment?
Right. I mean, we're kind of mixing apples and oranges.
But in the real world, these all come together.
If the landlord accepts the Section 8 tenant, and then Section 8 looks at the property and says, this is unacceptable to us, then that doesn't really invoke then the Section 8 discrimination, because the landlord was willing to take them, but Section 8 wasn't happy with the property itself. So for our purposes, that would be non-discrimination. On the other hand, if there was a modification that was necessary because of disability, not just because Section 8 wants it, it's totally different. But if there's a modification that's necessary for disability, that may be discrimination based on disability. But again, when it comes to modifications, reasonable modifications, first of all, it has to be reasonable. Second of all, the cost is to the person who needs the modification. An accommodation, like a parking space or a service animal, something like that, that cost would be to the landlord or the housing provider. So again, if it's a modification that the Section 8 wants, that wouldn't necessarily be discriminatory. The landlord would take the Section 8, but for Section 8 not proving the property.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, we just heard a couple of pronouncements from our good friends, Legislator Avenanti and Rogowski, about the real world. I would caution you both about making pronouncements about everyone's reality, because the reality I come from deals with tenants who are homeless because they had Section 8 vouchers that landlords wouldn't take. Okay, so let's not be talking about the real world. Maybe that's not your real world, but that's a lot of people's real world. You know, and this nonsense about it not working north of 287, that's the area that I come from and have managed affordable housing. There are plenty of opportunities north of 287, and we've discussed that at great length. You know, I really find it offensive that these proceedings have been compared to the O.J. Simpson trial.
Did that.
You know, I find that horrendously offensive. We've been doing this for 3 years, painstakingly, as you point out. And for somebody to show up at a meeting and say that we're rushing this thing through, we keep coming back to the same discussions, the same points made by the same people. Legislator Maizano put forward a good faith effort to get this across the finish line. You know, every time we have offered a compromise, it has come out of the hides of the tenant side. You know, we even went to the Building and Realty Institute with the promise that a voluntary plan would be put forward. You know, we're still waiting for that 2 years later. Okay, so there's been compromise and compromise and compromise. So, you know, to come in here and say that we're rushing this and that we're not dealing in the real world, you know, we've been through this and we've been through this and we've been through this. So, you know, the last point I want to make is this notion about hiring an attorney. You know, the people who can't afford an apartment can't afford an attorney, and they don't necessarily have the wherewithal to go find an attorney. So, you know, when we keep talking about this real world, you know, let's be cognizant of the fact that there are two different realities.
Can I
wait, you know, you guys want Chairman
I want to respond
Jenkins
to that,
and then Maizano, and then you can respond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to point out, because I do recall us going through this significant discussion, and we did have the law department and certainly Mary did a wonderful job of going into and creating spreadsheets for us with all the different variations of the civil penalties. But just because, you know, we have Google now, we can go in and we could look. New York City's law says this chapter shall be liable for a civil penalty of not more than $50,000 and an additional civil penalty of not more than $100,000. That's where we got it from, right?
That's so 150.
It's 50 and 150, right? Right. So I mean, the numbers didn't come out the air, and certainly, Mr. Chairman, you know, trying to focus on the issues that come from the Human Rights Office and how they've implemented it. I mean, we have time from when we've implemented these higher penalties. We have seen the results. And the only question I wanted to ask Josh was that you did mention a case on benevolent, what did you call it? Benevolent, I never heard that one before.
Benevolent discrimination.
Yeah, benevolent discrimination where someone's concerned. Can we just ask, what did the office do with that individual?
We actually ended up settling them. As we try with every single case that comes before us, we try to see if we can't conciliate between the parties. Sometimes it's an apology and a handshake. Sometimes it's respondents agreeing to undergo an hour or two of fair housing training. Sometimes it means an exchange of money or agreeing to rent the apartment.
In this case that you're talking about, with the benevolent, someone made a mistake, and you know, we heard so much testimony. I mean, I can't
insurance
even.
Company,
we had like, I don't even know. I mean, I want to say 6 or 8 hours of floor testimony, you know, on this particular item. And there's two different types of landlords that come to us when we hear. Some of them are Mrs. Murphy's, you know, law kind of items. In this case, what did you do with that person?
It was a recognition that it was a mistake, that it was not something that was...
Did you fine them?
No.
No, it was a settlement agreement, so there's no fines that apply.
Well, some of us, when we hear settlement, because we were under a housing stipulation order settlement that cost us, you know, $60 or $80 million. Settlement doesn't mean no money. In the case you're talking about, you basically counseled the person and said, no, don't do that again.
Basically,
that's okay. Exactly. Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Which is right. A good function.
Absolutely. Which is with the office,
and,
you know, the way.
And then
legislative
council,
legislative, we're going to try to reach some legislative.
I'm a little stuck on the macro point of the civil penalty, and let me just say my thinking, and I appreciate it. Ken just looked at the New York City law, and Dolores talked about how it possibly would be administered and hasn't been much of a record of the civil penalty. And I would just say this. Personally, and actually remember, I think Dolores, you and I had some interesting talks about this when we passed the housing law. I think I voted for that as a compromise, although I was never very comfortable with the piece of the civil penalty that didn't deal with any egregious conduct. I was fine with the civil penalty if someone did some type of egregious conduct. And I still feel that right now as we discuss it today. And just because New York did it that way doesn't mean Westchester has to do it that way. And I think we ought to talk further. Maybe it doesn't have to be today in the source of income, but it could maybe next week or a week, 2 weeks from now, whether we want to modify that and the civil penalties only for egregious conduct. That it, if it's going to be a deterrent, it can be a deterrent just for like compensatory type damage type thing, which is available to right now kind of. You know, because there's no control over it that says it's got to be for a typical type of conduct. They can give it any time they want. Now, they haven't. I understand history is they haven't yet. But, you know, who knows what happens. And, Dolores, you may not be there someday. And it may be a whole new board of directors 10 years from now. So, I don't know. I think it's worth a debate by all of us whether we want to continue to have that civil penalty for the 50,000 out there they can just use whenever they want, or just make the civil penalty for egregious conduct since it's supposed to be a deterrent. I think that's something we, as a board and a committee, need to talk about further.
Do you then reach the same conclusion? Because just as we are looking at, you and I have talked about this, as you said, willful, wanton, and malicious, and how do you decide what's willful, wanton, and malicious? How do you decide what's egregious? I think, you know.
I understand. We'll just play around with that. Right, that's a great question. Mm-hmm. Great point, Dolores. And like, as Legislative Notice said before, certainly those three words,
right.
You know, wanton and willful, They're defined all over in different types of legislation in the state and case law. So that's something we can have a basis for.
Let's say Robin
Nazi. First of all, willful, wanton, and delicious. That's delicious, yeah.
Delicious.
like your lunch.
Right. The three terms are not required. They're separate. And there's very big difference between willful, wanton, and malicious. And they all have the same penalty, and that's troublesome. If you're saying it's malicious, I can understand. Well, if it's malicious, then it deserves a high penalty. If it's wanton, that's very different than malicious. And that's kind of like gross negligence, I would think. And willful is just willful conduct. That's number one. Number two, in the real world, I have seen, I practice law. I don't represent big landlords. I represent the Mrs. Murphys, and I represent tenants. And I've been in both sides. And I had somebody just recently who just bought $1 million home and refused to move out because their home wasn't ready. But my client who bought the two-family house had to continue paying rent and begging his landlord, please let me stay another month, please let me stay another month because I can't move into the house that I bought because these people won't move out. And the judge just says, well, give him more time, give him more time, give him more time. This is somebody who's got a lot of money. This is somebody who's got the ability to play the system. So when you deal with that, you'll never get a poor tenant out, no matter what the circumstances of the landlord are. And I've seen that happen. I've had lots of two-family homes. I know this doesn't apply to two-family homes, but I'm just talking about the real world in court. So I understand what it's like, and it's not a fair system. I can't explain how it happens. It's the whim of the judges. Number three, with a landlord who says, hey, look, you know, I don't want to rent to you, and that's considered to be a violation because I'm afraid you might fall down the stairs. Well, what about his insurance company? That's business judgment. An insurance company would say to him, you're going to lose in court immediately. That guy fell down the stairs and you saw that he was walking with a cane and you have these types of stairs and you rented to him? Are you out of your mind? Well, his choice is lose a case possibly down the line because the guy trips and he's doing what he thinks is the right thing, or lose to the Human Rights Commission. We're putting people in these types of real-world situations. Okay, that's the problem we're dealing with when we're inserting ourselves so far in. Now, I have another suggestion, which hasn't been raised before, but listening to what Ken was saying before, and it has been raised by a couple of other people offline before. Maybe we ought to apply this to buildings where the landlord has taken the benefit of some government help.
So, you raised that before.
Well, have we ever had a discussion on that?
Yeah, and we decided not to pursue it.
Because it seems to me there the landlord has gotten... Well, we have, okay. I mean, because, you know, landlords who have stayed away from any kind of government help at all are just doing their own thing, and we have a whole series of regulations. The other thing, as I suggest, is that maybe we could possibly go to a situation where this is outside of the Human Rights Commission.
Outside the Human Rights Commission.
Because this is
We've
the part
discussed that before.
Well, I understand, but I've never been satisfied with the discussions of these or the
answers. Well, I've been satisfied. I know the commission has to go. The commission has to go. Dolores and Josh have to go down to another meeting, and we really appreciate the time you took to come up here. But before they leave, I want to say, I think the Human Rights Commission serves a very important function in dealing with these cases, because once they're in court, the chances of them getting settled become much less likely. They become, it's much more an adversarial proceeding, and having a commission that tries to conciliate matters, I'm sure, results in a lot more cases getting settled than would otherwise get settled and burdening the court system and putting money in lawyers' pockets. So thank you for coming. Thank you for answering our questions. And but we have considered that. And you know, the concern I have here, I think we have to wrap this up. Ms. Finger, I want to give you the
word.
Yeah.
Awesome. I apologize if I've offended anybody, and it was not an analogy to that trial. It was the idea of not forcing, you know, legislation. So, just with all due respect.
No, I appreciate that.
But I have two questions. One, that we haven't discussed at all, is on standard of review at the end of the
trial. No,
is this is how many cases were brought and what happened, or how many additional units of affordable housing have actually been created? I think that should be clear now, not at the end of the process when suddenly all of a sudden people are looking around and saying, well, should we continue it or not, and vote on it. We should know now what that is. Because the fact that you don't have cases, or you do have cases, you could have 100 cases, and whether the outcomes are one way or the other, may not matter if, in fact, the legislation
don't go
is
too far.
So I think that we need to talk about that and set that those standards in some at least broad outline now. And the second thing is, I think Tom raised good points, but I think this idea of disability and in this housing, where we are mixing apples and oranges and we're getting far afield, but that does not negate the problem of what is going to be considered willful or wanton or malicious if somebody simply says, I'm taking this person because they're not Section 8 and I don't want to take Section 8. That's a willful act. It's a statement. And it's not like the person who didn't take somebody who's just worried about the disability, because the disability is going to stand on its own. And anyone who does will stand on its own. So it's strictly some criteria here, and it seems that the person is going to be stuck at some point. You know, maybe people don't come in and say that, but if they've got proof that somebody said, I'm not taking you for that reason, that has the potential of being
open. Thank you. So, yeah.
I have a real world situation also. We're going to be talking about real world effects of this bill. And it's a tenant who came to us just about last week, who's an ETPA tenant, but she didn't know it, because when she moved into the building, her landlord had increased the rent from the previous tenant from $900 to over $1,400 a month. And now, when she fell behind on the $1,400 a month rent for 2 months, her landlord won't accept a subsidy, because he knows that the person who gave the one-shot deal, who's offering the one-shot deal in full, wants a copy of the lease. They just want a copy of the lease. They don't want to make a new lease or anything. They just want a copy of it for their records. And the landlord knows that if he has to give a copy of that lease, it'll become eminently clear that he's been overcharging this tenant for over 5 years, and so he won't take the subsidy. And with this bill, we're going to have to defend a non-payment case in court. There's going to be so much litigation overcharge and prosecute it.
Could it be CRS?
With this bill on the books, the tenant would be protected.
Thank you. Yes.
A couple of things. First of all, I don't know why NEI is singled out for participating in the process. I don't really understand. Secondly, we've heard stories. Now, we just heard a story about an ETPA situation. That landlord will be or should be brought up by the Division of Housing. There is remedy in state court and state law for abuses under ETPA, so that would be taken care of. So that tenant would not be a victim. Thirdly, we've heard a lot. I would respectfully submit, by the way, I'm just submitting this to the committee, is that this goes back to government operations and legislation to about 2007, the minutes. There's that one quantifiable...
I have one of those things.
Yeah.
Maybe the others need it.
There's that one quantifiable justification in terms of numbers for this law. Finally, in Mr. Hartman's district...
That's a lot of paper.
with Mr. Burton's district, some of the North County districts, if you have Section 8 applicants, the Mrs. Murphy's exemption deprives them of locating in the multifamily housing that's predominant in their neighborhood, Bedford, Pound Ridge, Mount Kisco. I mean, you do have a few buildings, 5 units and over, but predominant. The multifamily housing opportunities in North County are in the very buildings that are being exempt. So they may find housing in more urban areas like maybe Ossining Village or White Plains or Yonkers, Mount Vernon, New Rochelle, maybe some of the Hudson River communities, but they'd be far afield from their own particular neighborhoods and communities and perhaps families. So this is, again, and the industry has maintained this. The industry has maintained, one, that there may be indeed a voluntary program, much like a lot of the landlord-tenant groups in some of the municipalities in Westchester, have a voluntary landlord-tenant system as opposed to ETPA. Mr. Harkin said he's been waiting for the BRI for a plan. We are saying that why don't we sit down with our counterparts, our professionals on the other side, Mr. Hanbaum and Mr. Hanratty, and work out a voluntary system where we try it out for a year and see how the location of Section 8 applicants, see how that goes. This, for all the effort, appears to be a solution in search of a problem. And with our offer to work with the legislature and our colleagues across the aisle to form a voluntary system to try it out, that has always been on the table, and it remains there. But for all the effort, the need for this still is questionable.
And we've heard that argument before, too. The concern
is that...
Sometimes
things have to be reiterated.
Yeah, but we reiterated them ad nauseum, pretty much. The issues that we're really focusing on today were the sunset clause and the penalties, which we're going to...
Mr. Nona, I was answering a particular attack.
Understood.
Respectfully as I...
I do want to take a time out to skip to another issue, because we had two patient gentlemen here waiting to talk about another issue that we're not going to get to in full today, because we've got a lot of comments, as we usually do, on source of income. So we have two gentlemen here to testify about eminent domain, and I'd like you to please come up and we'll give you the floor, and we apologize for your patience.
No. We thank them. We appreciate their patience.
We apologize for keeping you here and appreciate your patience.
Requiring your patience.
Testing your patience.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks
for the opportunity.
I stand corrected.
I understand.
Thank you. Thank you.
Which one of you is Mr. Lozito?
I'm going alphabetical order, I guess.
Can I just give a disclosure in advance? When I was a town councilman, my vote on a contested vote made him the town planner for Granberg. Doesn't mean I agree with what everything he says.
That just killed your testimony.
I saw that was part of the check and pass.
Right out from London.
Right. Okay.
Before you even say
gentlemen.
Well, with that said, my name is Bruce Lozito. I'm a urban planner and attorney involved with community planning and real estate development in Westchester for 35 years. My formative years actually spent working for the town of Greenberg for 11 years in various capacities, including community development director and commissioner of community development conservation. So I'm here today because my orientation, my passion, if you will, is good community planning, revitalization of neighborhoods that are in state of deterioration, be they low and moderate income neighborhoods, be they neighborhoods that have just changed over time as the needs of the community have changed and their current uses become obsolete. There's a need for change and a need for redevelopment and revitalization. I do now largely represent private development companies, but I wanted to make that statement first to describe that my orientation first and foremost, and it's self-serving in some respects, that a project that is right for the client and the community is the best project, and it's the one that gets through the process most quickly and painlessly, if you will, and serves both the community and the private client. So there are approaches that can be taken that are win-wins for both the community and for the private sector. The emphasis has been of late in redevelopment. In the past 5 or 6 years, that's been the thrust of all of my work, taking areas along the waterfront, in the village of Sleepy Hollow in particular, where I worked on Ichabod's Landing with Ginsberg Development Corp and transformed the parking lot that served the General Motors site into a townhouse community, a public waterfront park, and actually your board supported that project with Riverwalk funding to help extend the Riverwalk along the Hudson River in that section of the county. Now I've been involved with a redevelopment project, a major redevelopment project in the village of Portchester on Fox Island, which some of you may know. I've been working very closely with the community on that project for at least 4 years. It's in an existing urban renewal area. It's largely industrial. It's the village's DPW yard is there and other issues that I'll talk about a little more in a minute. But that's been the thrust of my activity. And in urban renewal areas, in downtown and waterfront areas where revitalization and redevelopment need to occur, eminent domain is an essential tool. It's obviously a sensitive issue, and I realize the motivation for proposing this legislation was out of sensitivity to the problems that may arise from it. But I'd be concerned about taking a blanket position on it that was detrimental to helping communities do urban revitalization and waterfront redevelopment by making it impossible to get county funding to assist with those efforts. As government funding is very critical to these types of projects. Used to be in the past, in the 1960s and 70s, that the federal government footed the majority of the bill for urban renewal projects, 75% with the state and the locality paying the rest. They did all the acquisition, they did all the site clearing with government money, and then sold the land that had been cleared to private developers. The situation is entirely different now. There is no government money for that type of thing. There are no programs, and so the private sector must take on all the risk from the onset of trying to fulfill the visions that the community has declared in its planning as objectives for the community, but again, at the developer's risk almost entirely. And that has to be recognized, and the need for government assistance and how critical it is to these projects needs to be recognized. So in terms of the fundamental points I wanted to raise, we are, as you know, in a devastating situation as far as our economic condition, which seems to be improving on some fronts, but in the real estate sector, it's still a complete loss, completely devastated, no construction, no new development whatsoever. We need to be focusing our efforts on stimulating that in a positive way, in a properly planned way, and that's where our emphasis should be, helping the private sector and the public sector to work together to achieve the goals of the community, stimulate our activity in construction and development, and help to bolster our community's tax bases. smart growth. Everyone is aware of the detriments of suburban sprawl, of greenfield development, as it's called, going out in previously undeveloped areas and impacting the environment by creating new developments there, some of which is necessary, but some of which does further sprawl. So the emphasis is turning again, and wisely so, toward rebuilding on what we have in our downtowns, in our waterfront areas, to take advantage of our infrastructure, utilities, transportation, and to stop the inefficient spread and sprawl of new developments. So fulfilling our needs in already developed areas is critical. We should respect the communities at the local level and their ability to plan and understand the needs of their community as well as the opportunities that they have to change and be able to work with the private sector to advance those plans. And again, we'll undoubtedly need to look to the county, to the state, whatever other resources are available to help with these types of projects. I'm particularly concerned about many of the urban areas of our county, Port Chester, New Rochelle, Mount Vernon, Yonkers, and others, where redevelopment is pretty much the only game in town. They're largely developed, not to the best possible use of their resources and infrastructure, and not necessarily suiting their existing needs. So redevelopment is key, and you've seen a lot of that activity discussed proceeding in some under construction in the past few years. And again, the need for the county to support those efforts versus possibly hindering them by withholding funds can be very serious detrimental to the success of these things. Most of these projects involve environmental cleanup. They're industrial areas, heavily contaminated. There are a whole host of other issues that a developer has to overcome at great risk and expense to get to the point where these projects can be put in the ground. And if I may, just for a moment, talk about the Port Chester project in particular. It's a 13.5-acre area of land. It's called the Harborfront Redevelopment Area that exists where the Byram River meets the Long Island Sound. The majority of it, 7.5 acres, is currently the village's DPW site. It's been used for a lot of somewhat nasty things over the years. It was an incinerator site. Much of the land was filled with incinerator ash. It had been land under water before that time. So there are clearly environmental mitigation measures that will be needed that will cost in the millions of dollars. It's an incredibly spectacular location on the Sound waterfront with fabulous views of the Sound. It's being wasted, in my opinion, largely by having a DPW facility there that the public really can't utilize in any sense of the word. There's also a private yacht club there that leases part of the land from the village of Port Chester, but public access to that portion of the site is almost equally limited, except for a small boat ramp that the public is allowed to bring boats and launch boats. So there's an opportunity lost there that's unique on Long Island Sound, and certainly in the village of Port Chester. There are a number of private properties there, a handful, fortunately, only 5 or 6. Most of them are industrial. There's one single-family residence there, believe it or not, because it's really an industrial area. It also has a county sewage treatment plant right there. But most of the properties are industrial in nature already. Undoubtedly, there's going to be environmental issues with the fill, and most of them could readily be relocated. But all of that requires a great deal of effort and cooperation and combined resources. The project in that case is a plan for a mixed-use development with 400 units of housing of various costs and types, townhouses, condominium apartments and the like, a restaurant, waterfront restaurant, shops, things that can bring people down to the waterfront to enjoy it, whereas now they have no reason to go there, except maybe Fish Restaurant, if you've ever been there.
Very good.
That's one opportunity. That doesn't have quite the views, and in fact, we wouldn't mind being able to relocate a restaurant like that or that restaurant to a more prominent location on the waterfront on the Sound where the views would be fantastic. So these are all things that the village has been working with us for about 4 years, and I'm really concerned about taking any steps that would hinder that at this late stage of the game, especially since hundreds of thousands of dollars have been spent on the due diligence work and the planning, and millions more will have to be spent before a shovel can be put in the ground. So that's my particular intimately known interest. But the same things apply to just about everything else that's going on in terms of redevelopment, Hudson River Shore, South Shore, and Michelle, and Bay, the General Motors site, and that happens to be a privately owned site, but there has been redevelopment components to it. All very essential that we don't disturb the balance of the risks and the rewards to the point where the risks become too great and these projects aren't pursued. Another part of that is the affordable housing component, which virtually every one of these projects does include. We have a vision for doing rehabilitation of existing deteriorated housing in a nearby area, building new affordable housing for ownership opportunities. There's a lot of pluses that can be gained by these kinds of efforts. And mine is not unique in that regard, but it has a lot of very interesting components that I think are very positive for the community. Clearly, eminent domain needs to be a last resort. And I can tell you that there is very little incentive for a developer to use that tool. As we've seen in recent litigation, the cost of fighting these cases after the fact is tremendous, the delay is tremendous, and it's a very big unknown. You don't know what the financial settlement is going to be at the end of the day when the courts decide. And it's really in the interest for the developers, very often, to offer more than the land is worth, more than a fair market value, so that that process is not necessary. And that's been the experience, I think, of very many communities in this kind of an owner extension. Another opportunity that exists in Portchester is building a 1,600-foot waterfront esplanade that we'll be able to do after we clear the land. There's a possibility of connecting that to the downtown waterfront, which the county has already also invested in previously. So the recent court actions that have been taken, most recently with the Columbia University case, indicate that the courts are paying a lot closer attention to this issue than they may have been in the past. At least the New York courts certainly are. They're making the agencies that undertake these projects and the private parties that undertake these projects demonstrate that there was a public benefit, a significant public benefit to these undertakings. And that the proper studies were done to substantiate them. And they're not just turning a blind eye and rubber stamping local decisions the way they were accused of doing in the past. So I think all the forces are coming together, recognizing that there needs to be greater scrutiny paid to how this is done and when it's used. But it needs to be a component of the effort. I could say in Portchester that probably a key property was acquired after the request for proposals were done for this project, and 20-some-odd years after an urban renewal area was created there. So clearly there was knowledge of the redevelopment. And I would be afraid that if this tool is not kept available, it could conceivably foster speculation and holdouts for individual gains versus recognizing the larger gains of a larger community. So there has to be a balancing, but it needs to be really carefully thought out. And I don't think you want to enact anything that would be a stumbling block the communities realizing their revitalization efforts. And I know you've always stepped up to the plate whenever possible to help, and I would think that you still want to do that, but with some greater scrutiny as to how it takes place to make sure that all was fair, all was well thought out. I think Michael will talk about that. So I hope you give it every consideration and not a heck hasty. It was as well intentioned as this is, it does have problems.
Do I have to make a disclaimer about you, too? On the cases where we work together and against each other and whatever.
You have to disclaim everything. All right, well,
that means you're disqualified from voting or even commenting on that?
No, just give me more insight into cross-examining them. That's it.
We try to take a couple of people with me for okay. Well, my name's Michael Tarrant. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak today. Bruce suggested that it might be a good idea for me to come in and maybe share with you some of the experience I've had on this topic. My experiences have been in many of your communities and, you know, projects that you're intimately aware of. So if I'm redundant, I apologize in advance. My experience has been dealing mostly representing municipalities as special land use counsel in complicated urban redevelopment projects, many of which have involved some element of eminent domain. Most recently, New Rochelle, Mount Vernon, the redevelopment of the waterfront of Glen Cove, City of Glen Cove, Village of Ossining, and others. Our firm is a boutique, and that's all we do is land use, so we really come at this from all angles. We've also represented over the years a number of landowners and condominees. So we really do try to look at this in a balanced way, and somewhat, as Bruce is saying, is what's good government planning, what's fair, and how do you balance and weigh many competing concerns and factors. I just want to start off with, if anyone, I certainly recognize the visceral public reaction and response to the United States Supreme Court in Kelo, and fully cognizant of certain abuses that have occurred in eminent domain matters over time involving the taking of private property for economic development purposes. Clearly, eminent domain should never be used to facilitate what's known as the private land grab, the image of the quintessential grandmother being thrown into the street to make way for a casino makes everyone cringe, or for that matter, closer to the heart of some of you. I'm sure some of the matters that arose during the New Rochelle Kia matter resonated and had some negative implications. I would respectfully submit that in my experience, and like I've said, I've been on all sides of this, that abuses in this proceeding are the exception and most and must not become the overriding guide for the development of public policy in this area. That when properly employed, eminent domain is an invaluable and irreplaceable tool for rational, long-term governmental planning, especially, as Bruce mentioned, in connection with the revitalization of many maturing and financially restrained suburban cities and municipalities, including those in the county of Westchester, where eminent domain remains essential to implementing critical public improvements and public purposes.
Bill.
I am concerned that the current law being proposed in the committee is excessive and would have the effect of unnecessarily impeding a critical governmental function that can be more effectively addressed through other less draconian means. I think when you look at the history of eminent domain, this is sort of where we start. It's overlooked that the constitutional protections relating to the exercise of eminent domain were adopted specifically because the nation recognized that the power to condemn private property was fundamental to the country's development and broad public welfare. And I submit that the revitalization of our nation's urban areas and suburban urban areas is part of that natural historic evolution of such public purpose doctrine. For example, few today would question the public purpose, quote-unquote, behind the condemnation of private property to make way for highways, railways, canals. These infrastructure improvements were often accomplished in cooperation with or to the benefit of private interests. In our nation's youth, it was also clear that these infrastructure improvements were required to promote the general welfare. Well, starting in the mid-20th century, under the leadership of individuals like Mayor LaGuardia, civic leaders began to recognize that blighted and distressed urban neighborhoods themselves were the infrastructure that stood in need of repair. And in the absence of vital downtown and neighborhood redevelopment, that these neighborhoods were the social fabric that tied diverse like communities like many in Westchester today began to fray. And therefore, the use of eminent domain became a critical power that older urban and suburban cities unfortunately sometimes required to address these ills. And most land, as Bruce said, most land in the old urban and suburban communities in Westchester were developed long ago. These communities have little vacant buildable land. In the same regard, many Westchester downtown and former industrial neighborhoods in particular are underutilized. Many lack rational, compatible land uses. Much of the downtown infrastructure and housing stock is old and in need of repair. I don't need to tell you that the overall tax base of any of these municipalities are strained and to continue to decline. yet these municipalities must often provide increased social services while realizing decreased revenue. Enhancing municipal's tax base, reusing and developing underutilized areas, promoting orderly growth, creating jobs, and expanding neighborhood vitality, all are as much a legitimate public service, in my opinion, today as the construction of the nation's public utilities and roads were in the 1900s. I think, as Bruce mentioned, the involvement of private entities in the transformation of these municipalities and the exercise of municipal eminent domain is also critical to achieving these goals and must be preserved. Although it currently has become tainted in the public's eye, it remains that most municipalities lack sufficient resources to undertake the necessary urban development efforts. And I'll just skip through this, but what in the 1960s, when you didn't have private development involved and lined up as a partnership, what would happen is you would have a condemnation of an area, and then what you would have are these areas remain vacant for 20, 30, 40 years. That was the quote-unquote slum clearance of the 1960s. And one of the things that has been addressed by bringing private development into the process right from the onset is to know you have the project, know what that project is going to be, often have a land development agreement entered into with respect to the respective obligations of the parties, and most of the times that document is public. Again, so I think the involvement of the private sector, where it has been sort of received a sort of stain and has been highly criticized, is critical to the effective use of eminent domain. I want to just reiterate what Bruce said about the courts. There's no question that there are abuses, but there's also no question that the courts in New York State are increasingly heightened in scrutinizing the public purpose. As Justice Kennedy warned in Kelo, in the decision that was highly criticized, and he was the deciding opinion, he was quoted as aptly stating, "There may be categories of cases in which transfers are so suspicious or the procedures employed so prone to abuse or the benefits are so trivial or implausible that court should presume an impermissible private purpose." And I think the New York courts in particular have really taken this warning to heart. One just needs to go through the decision that Bruce wouldn't invoke, but the first decision of that kind in New York State was the Second Department case in Havistra across the river involving the Ginsburg Organization, where the court found that the condemnation, the public purpose, was illusory and a mere pretext to confer benefit upon certain private entities. That was post-Kelo. It was the first court in New York State to undermine or reject the public purpose. It didn't attack the underlying premise of using condemnation for economic development, but it took the Kennedy warning to heart and held the redeveloper and the municipality to those standards. The most recent one, as Bruce mentioned, was the First Department's decision in Cower versus New York State Urban Development Corp, where it rejected the use of rejected the public purpose rationalization for the state helping Columbia University in its expansion plans. And there the court found that the public purpose was a quote-unquote afterthought and failed to offer credible evidence that the Manhattanville area was truly blighted. So I think with respect to some of the underlying concerns that's motivated this legislation, I can say very confidently that the New York State courts are going to be going through the intense case-by-case scrutiny that's really the underpinning and the rationale that I know this legislation was meant to address. Another possible solution that this committee and the legislature might consider is really augmenting the public purpose test wherever this county funding or participation involved. Now there's a 204 test which has been called in New York State the quote-unquote whatever syndrome, and there's really no standards under Section 204 of the eminent domain law for what constitutes statutorily public purpose. As I said before, the courts and the common law are beginning to tackle that. But I would suggest that what this committee may want to address and really get to the heart of the issue that you're talking about and not come up with what I think is a very dangerous blanket prohibition is requiring wherever there's an involvement of the county participation that the 204 finding explicitly address the issues that we discussed in Kelo. What's the public character of the condemnation? How does the condemnation fit into an overall integrated development plan? The extent of the private benefits bestowed or the public benefit versus the private character? The fairness of the procedures employed in the condemnation process? And whether the takings of the particular properties were reasonably necessary to achieving the intended public purpose. These were the strands, these were the criteria that the Kelo Court articulated should be considered. These are the criteria that came out of the Haverstraw case. These are the criteria that were articulated in the Columbia case. I would respectfully submit that if the county really wants to begin focusing on that, that they would find a way to write these criteria right into the determination and I think begin to require the balancing test, which frankly is the same balancing test that has emerged for regulatory takings. I mean, this is almost the same test that the United States Supreme Court in Penn Central requires of every municipality now in defending a regulatory taking. And that the Supreme Court, again, reiterated most recently in the Lake Tahoe case, where they eschewed a bright line test, sort of like being that sort of underlying the legislation here, or a rigid formula for determining for regulatory takings and balancing the public interest versus the economic benefits and who derives those economic benefits. And again, as the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court has always talked about its takings, what's fair? At the end of the day, that is, in the most simplest form, the analysis, is what's fair and have the procedures been fair and open and transparent and honest. And then again, if those criteria are articulated, and findings are made, and the record is developed, any condemnee, any landowner, most third parties have a right to bring an administrative challenge. And that administrative challenge then will have a full record addressing those issues in which to deal with. Right now, and again, I've been litigated on both sides, it's been interesting, but up until recently, the courts, I had one where I represent a landowner, the second department made short shrift of what I thought was a very compelling argument in opposition to public purpose in a two-paragraph decision because there was no record. And the second department had nothing to go by with respect to the public purpose and the public purpose doctrine. The county might also want to consider as an alternative to this legislation exploring some type of creation or mandating mediation or dispute resolution procedures wherever there is a municipality seeking to condemn private land for public purpose. Florida is the first state that has implemented this specifically for eminent domain, and it's been very successful. Most recently, I was involved in the city of New Rochelle in a similar situation where the city mediated a very contentious dispute between the redeveloper who was engaged in the condemnation and the private party, where of course the city would have been an actor but sort of tried to play more of a neutral role and was successful in mediating and coming up with a very fair agreement that integrated and found a role for that landowner in the future development of that property. Now that property has not, that development has not gone forward, but it's not gone forward because of the economic reasons, but it avoided the litigation that occurred in White Plains with many of the same parties. So again, I think guess in my experience, it's sometimes critical to have a third party that can step back, and it doesn't have to be binding mediation. It doesn't have to be indefinite, but very often that's a procedure that can narrow the issues and at least avoid a lot of the potential litigation and contentiousness that comes out of these types of proceedings. Again, just sort of wrapping up, in my experience, there are abuses, no question. And any time I work with a municipality, I'm very clear to advise that the process needs to be open, needs to be transparent, needs to be honest, and needs to have integrity. And most of the times, that deals with 90 to 95% of the situations that might arise that causes the type of laws or things that are evolving today. In those instances where it doesn't resolve those, I'll be very frank. 50% of those are the landowner who's seeking a premium and seeking the highest return and compensation for their property. And many times the redeveloping municipality will pay that premium to make this happen. And then 50% of those very rare times, you'll have a situation where someone truly doesn't want to move, doesn't know where to move, is uprooting their entire life, and doesn't know why or how they were put in such a situation. And that's where the rubber hits the road, and you have these type of anecdotes that invokes the type of reaction that you had to Kilo. In final, I think the ability to utilize condemnation as a last resort is critical to the types of projects that I've been involved. Sometimes it is the only way of assembling a critical mass of property that is essential to having any meaningful redevelopment of the type of areas I think we would all agree require redevelopment and are truly in the public purpose and for the greatest social welfare. And no question, there are those abuses, but I think they can be addressed in a more precision type way and more effectively than the proposed legislation, which I think is overbroad and a little too simplistic in its approach. So I appreciate it.
Could you have some applause in the room? Thanks for your time.
Do we have any time for discussion? Not really.
No, we're going to discuss this next week. But would you like to ask them if they come back and answer questions? Or?
Well, I think they raised some interesting questions.
Yeah.
I disagree with the philosophy from where they're coming, but I think they raised some interesting questions. I mean, maybe I'll have a beer with Bruce and have a discussion, but I mean, you've got places in the world where they don't use this kind of stuff, and places just kind of like redevelop themselves. I mean, in Europe, they still live in stuff that we tore down 200 years ago. You know, they've been redeveloped, and so we don't do that kind of seriously, we don't do that kind of redevelopment.
One of the things you ought to consider that they raised is the definition of public use.
Right.
And whether you could expand that to take into account some of the situations they raised where, you know, eminent domain does make sense for what may be, under your definition, not available under your definition of public use, but maybe it's worth looking at. I know you deal with, their definition, and this is Legislator Misano and Abenanti's draft, the acquisition of property to cure a concrete harmful effect of the current use of the land, including the removal of public nuisance structures that are beyond repair, that are unfit for human habitation or use. That goes to a certain extent, but maybe you would suggest expanding it somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, that's where it started.
Yeah.
You know, 75 years ago when you talked about the quintessential slum. But, you know, our issues, if anyone has been involved in the complicated redevelopment of a waterfront, for example, where, as Bruce said, is a contaminated waterfront, has obsolete industrial uses on it, like bus terminals that are keeping that waterfront from reopening, factories where there would be no other, you know, that if you go up to someone and you voluntarily ask them, would you voluntarily move? Because every redeveloper, And every municipality, in the first instance, as Bruce said, there's no question that the benefits of a consensual sale outweigh condemnation at every level.
Let me go to one point.
Tom, it outweighs it economically because you typically have to pay a significant premium, including what most people don't realize is you pay for land, and then you pay this fixture payment. That is this arcane area of condemnation.
Well, this is what I wanted to get to, right? Okay, but what you're paying current value. Right? You're paying current market value for the sale for its current use. See, this is the area that we can't affect, if I'm understanding this correctly, unless we can somehow put our own policy in place on this.
I think the eminent domain procedure law would probably prohibit
us from doing it. Here's the problem that I see. You've got a waterfront restaurant, okay? And this restaurant has made it through tough times and good times. But the landowner of this said, you know, someday I'm going to retire. This is a very valuable piece of property. They're going to build up all around me, and I'm going to sell my restaurant to some other guy who can afford to take my restaurant over. But I'm holding it for 20 years. And so now all of a sudden the economy's down. All values are down. And some developer comes in and says, you know what, I'm going to give you fair market value. Well, he's not getting a piece of the potential gain, which is why he invested in this property all along. He's getting what he could sell it for today, which is very little. He had planned to hold it for another 10 years and benefit from the, let's face it, location is what you're selling.
Yeah, but that looks at, you're looking at condemnation and this 101 without looking at, when you redevelop an area and when you need condemnation, it's typically not with this one user. You need it where you need to redevelop an entire area. That might have 8 or 9 blighted parcels or underutilized parcels. And you might have, and everyone else might say, look, I'll take the money and go relocate and go to an area that's, I'm not a non-conforming use. I'm not in a blight area, the like, and sometimes that one parcel that is not quote unquote blighted is in some respects the victim of this overall redevelopment attempt. But they would never get the value of that full thing because the value that you're talking about comes from the assemblage of all 10 parcels.
Correct. But that person paid a premium 20 years ago because that person had the vision to say, I'm going to locate here with a fish restaurant because it's on the water and people will come to me and someday the neighborhood around me will get better and I will have a good piece of property.
Tom, I think if you can carry this discussion offline and then we can...
But I think that's one of the fallacies.
I think both of you laid out a rationale on why local governments and maybe developers engaged in economic development wouldn't want our law.
Right.
And I can understand that. We have a significant policy difference here because we don't agree with what you set forth today. I agree that we could modify our law and we could make some changes on the lines that John said if we wanted to play with the definition of public purpose. But you're coming at it from the viewpoint of the developers and the local governments and what a local government may deem as a proper public use. I understand that. We're not there. We're thinking about the private property rights of the people that don't want to sell their house. And you said some people will go eventually, as both of you said, you know, a lot of times they work very well with the developer early on and they work, but they didn't want to leave their property. Most of them never wanted to leave their property. We don't want people to be forced to use their property by the specter of eminent domain or the use of eminent domain.
Would you apply the same standards for condemnation to require a road?
Yes.
Or a sewer plant?
Because we believe that's a genuine public use and taking someone's private property, a small business, a home, something like that, that's not an appropriate public use to us.
The philosophical difference is not the use of, what you're saying is not the use of condemnation and the government use of condemnation. You're saying what's a public purpose?
Yes.
That the economic development of older, mature cities and the redevelopment and building a tax base and your job and all those things are not a public purpose and are not part of the government's
yes.
I have a fundamental...
Sales tax is not a public use. Sales tax is not a public use. It's a
let me come in somewhere in between.
Legislative burden has had that.
Well, I just wanted to piggyback that. Go ahead.
The public purpose definitions that you've laid out here, Mike, are terrific. Maybe you'll just say, well, I stole them all from Kelo. But nevertheless, it's the first time I'd ever seen them laid out in a what's now considered to be a discredited form, bullet points, where they can be understood. And while everything has a vagueness to it, this is it seems to me more precise than most of what we've been seeing. The point that was raised regarding mediation, because if we narrow this down in the way you have described the situation, the obvious public purposes of the sewer plant and the bridge and the highway, they amount to, let's just arbitrarily say, 3/4 of all the transactions. The remaining portion falls into two categories, those of which are so obvious to either involving a speculator or someone who is simply trying to milk the system and has to be dealt with, and the person who has a genuine heartfelt and fair desire to stay no matter what. No matter what happens around them. The little old lady that's going to stay, the building on 6th Avenue behind Rockefeller Center, that one piece of property around which Rockefeller Center has been built, and there are occasionally other stories that go this way, are probably speculative excesses. But there are kinds where they exist. The use of mediation... I've always been a little bit chary of, but have you got experiences that you can tell us where this has worked out and achieved either? I mean, if it just comes down to money, which I don't think these particular cases are inherently about money, but they do ultimately have to be resolved in a monetary way. Or are there other things where you can, I don't know what, relocate the little old lady to Heritage Hill, so into a much more nice place than she would have in her 83rd year. How does this mediation work in these kinds of zero-sum game situations?
The mediation that I was involved in dealt with a commercial landowner who felt a little bit sort of where Tom was, that they had made an investment in an area, wanted to be the entity that would recognize the fruits of their investment and alike. And
the big score speculative, albeit use during that period of time.
And
what's
I
the benefit
do,
of the game?
I believe was sincere, mm-hmm. as opposed to just driving up the price, was rooted in that area and felt a sincere desire to be part of that redevelopment, and thus when the city came in and announced its purpose to redevelop the area and was able to reach, the redeveloper was able to reach voluntary agreements with all the other landowners, that particular landowner immediately sued and said, I'm going to engage in what I call effectively a full-scale guerrilla war to hold up this redevelopment, either for a maximum payoff or to kill the project. In that case...
Or be allowed to remain and continue developing because, their own spot.
Tom, I'm trying to drive this somewhere, which
okay,
I
good.
Think you're...
So the
okay.
city,
yeah.
the city in this particular stepped back and said, look, we're going to play a neutral role. We're going to truly facilitate the discussions between the redeveloper and to this landowner, and try to find a way that everyone feels that the process has been fair, the outcome has been fair, that everyone's concerns have really been taken into consideration, and eminent domain is not going to be used as this intimidation to either drive the price down or to force a consensual sale. And literally there were probably about 5 or 6 meetings and a very, very complex agreement was worked out, where in this case, the project was permitted to go forward, and this landowner had the choice of either participating in a piece of the project in the future, or opting out and being cashed out. But it was their choice to make that decision at a certain part in the evolution of the project. So, and I do believe in the same respects that that concept can work with the residential landowner that's feeling powerless, might feel powerless, and might be split on where do I go next and how do I go next. And in New York State, under New York State eminent domain law, you're not required to have a relocation plan, quote unquote, as you are under federal law. Now, most responsible condemnation plans, even under state law, will require a municipality to have a relocation office and work with people to find as good or better. But there's an emotional, I don't need to tell anybody here, and I know what you're talking about, any uprooting of your neighborhood, there are emotional ties to that. And that can be a very, especially if an older resident, someone who's lived their whole life there, I mean, that could tear the heart and soul out of a person and requires a tremendous amount of hand-holding and sensitivity and working with them to make sure that they end up in a place that really works for them. And I think a responsible municipality should be required to do that, but I think mediation can require that and would act if the redeveloper and the municipality is not as sensitive as they should be to that. Certainly a third party would be.
No, I just so you know, I think your mediation suggestion is excellent. Well, the only problem is we may be preempted.
Yeah. But that's what
to add that to anything we do here.
Well,
we've got
like
some limitations of what we can do.
What I'd like to get at is exactly this question of the mediation brought in county law. Is that just, are we just too small a fish in this and it really should be implemented at a state level? If that's so, if it in fact is either preempted or we're just too small a fish to really be able to do this in the relatively few cases that are going to arise on
the guess is A, we're preempted, and or we really don't have the jurisdiction to do that, but it's something we can continue to discuss.
Tom's given an example, and Mike Zarin has been in Austin, dealt with an example. The business that will be uprooted because it's a little retail store really has no place to go. Or the flavor sciences people in Austin who had really no place to go.
The shoemaker's business
but see, that's a little bit different. If you're site-specific because there's no other place for you to go within 30 miles, which was flavor sciences' problem, and we basically put them out of business with the waterfront renewal in Austin, versus the hardware store, which may have another place to go in the redevelopment if the redevelopment contemplates retail.
Right.
The restaurant, where it contemplates retail. You mentioned participation in the process, which is what the negotiation and the mediation would lead to. So there, it always strikes me that the tough ones are the guys who are going to be destroyed.
The fish restaurant who's not going to have any room to stay on the restaurant.
But the example, that's exactly the opposite one. I'm talking about the flavor sciences or the people who have, where you've got a retail business that there's no retail in the redevelopment. It's going to be 6th Avenue or something.
It's important.
I'm just trying to see if there is any point to even fighting this fight out over this law, or whether we're just going to come to a yay or nay on it, using mediation, or whether we just have to take this to the state.
Can I have a perfect lead-in? This is what I want to say to both of you.
I was trying to serve you a softball straight down the middle.
No, it's excellent. Here's what I want to say to you both. I appreciate you taking the time to come. Appreciate your thoughts. You gave us a perspective that's important. We have to hear from all sides here. I believe Tom and I and other legislators supporting our law intend to move forward with this. But you bring a lot of expertise here. Take a look at the language. If you have other angles we should add, other changes to the legislation, added clauses, some common ground we can find, we are wide open on that. We will sit there. We will talk to you. We're happy to have input. We're not saying that this is the version that has to be voted on. We do have a fundamental policy difference. We can go on the law and probably debate it for an hour. That's cool. That's the process here. But I do want you to know that we're open to discuss our language in further depth.
Okay. That's a good way to conclude this discussion for now. So let me just address going forward on both eminent domain and source of income. Since we've lost most of our members, we're not going to make any decisions today. and obviously with respect to eminent domain, we've just kind of started the discussion. So I'd like to start the meeting
again,
next week.
Again, you should know it was, we went at least this far. Two years ago.
If we could start the meeting next week and everyone bring their lunch, make sure this goes out at 12. We're going to leave ourselves enough time to discuss all of this stuff. On eminent domain.
Jim, we got rules at 12.
We'll do 12:30. Okay, eminent domain. County Attorney's Office will be here next week. The first topic we need to discuss, which I wanted to get into today, but I didn't want to hold these gentlemen up, is their opinion from 2005 that we are preempted from enacting anything. And so we need to discuss that. We need you to come up, or someone to come up, to basically provide the opinion and defend it, because legislators Abinanti and Mizano are undoubtedly going to disagree with it.
Also, just for the record, they're relying on a legal opinion from 5 years ago, which is about three versions ago of the law.
Mr. Chairman, I want you to understand.
We'll make copies for you. Yeah. There was also a 2006 opinion that you were not given, which says the county can do certain things in eminent domain.
So let's have all the opinions, even if it's an updated one. Number two, the other issue that we need to readdress, and maybe there's no changes to the original opinion, is whether it requires a mandatory referendum, because it curtails legislative power.
It might.
That's an issue. The third item we should discuss next week is there is a proposal in the state Senate, and I believe Amy Paulin from Westchester is carrying it in the Assembly, to amend the eminent domain procedure law and other aspects of the eminent domain law. And the question is, let's look at that. Let's make let's see where that is and whether we want to tweak our law with respect to that.
I don't think we can.
And if that's enacted, it may preempt our law.
What that is response is, both of these guys could tell us in depth, is Lippman's opinion, where he talked about the problems in state law regarding the being blighted.
She's got a definition of blight.
She wants to define blighting in a better way in the state law.
We're going to update opinions on, and all the opinions on, the preemption issue, the referendum issue, look at the state law proposal. Number four is to look at this public purpose definition. And gentlemen, we welcome any suggestions you have. You know, assuming we try to enact something, how you could accommodate some of the issues, because it seems to me the definition of public purpose would be the place to do it. And five, Mike, if you have any information on the Florida mediation procedure, send it to us, and we should look at, is it a statute, or is it an informal?
I have to go back and check.
That would be helpful. All right, so that's, everybody okay, eminent domain?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, well done.
That's 2 hours next week.
What time is that going to start?
12:30. No, at 12:30 we're going to do a source of income, because we got to try to vote that out, and I'll tell you what I intend to do next week on that, and you can tell me whether you disagree or not. But eminent domain will be the sex. So figure 130 for eminent domain. Source of income, you know, we've rehashed this so many times, and some of the issues people forget have been raised and resolved. But the two issues that are still on the table that have need some final resolution is the sunset provision. And I would like the county attorney to look at the two issues that Ms. Finger raised. I want to be able to give her an answer. And Marty Rogowski raised. If a tenant moves out, let's assume the tenant's a Section 8 tenant, moves in before that we enact our law. The sunset takes place. That tenant moves out. Does the landlord have to take a Section 8 tenant after our law expires?
It's assumed that tenant has to stay, correct?
No, it's assuming the tenant moves out.
No, what about the circumstances
where
the tenant stays?
We'll get to that. One question at a time. We've got three questions. Okay. The issue, so the tenant moves out. Does the landlord have to take a Section 8 tenant? And assume it's not a project-based Section 8 voucher, it's a voucher the individual has. Understand, if it's a project-based voucher, this law never even comes into effect, because it attaches to the apartment.
Right.
Issue number two that was raised by Ms. Finger, if it's a, and in number one, assume it's an ETPA apartment. Right. Number two, if a landlord has never taken Section 8, and then he takes Section 8, and then our law expires, is he then required to take future Section 8 tenants? I think I got that question.
That's the same as the first one.
No, it's not, because the first one doesn't take into account federal law. And the question was under federal law. If the second one's different for this reason. Let me take a shot at this. The landlord has taken a Section 8 tenant. That Section 8 tenant has not left. That Section 8 tenant is there. The law expires. a new apartment opens up, is the landlord required to take a Section 8 tenant for that new apartment?
Make it simpler. Start with the first question. Does he have to keep that tenant?
Okay. The third question, which I think the answer, well, I don't want to assume the answer. Third question is, there's a Section 8 tenant, the law expires, can he terminate the lease as to that Section 8 tenant? Right? That's your question. So three questions.
Well, let's go the other way with it. Number one is you have a tenant, take Section 8 under our law. The tenant is still there when the law expires.
Right.
What are the rights of that tenant and the rights of that landlord? That's question one. Question two, the tenant voluntarily leaves.
Right.
What's the obligation of the landlord with respect to that apartment and with respect to any improvements that the landlord made as a result of that lease with Section 8?
I don't understand the question about the improvements.
Okay.
What is that?
Because there is a, again, in my law practice, having done a little bit of everything, I've represented tenants challenging landlords who have tried to get increases on the basis of improvements to buildings.
Excuse me, gentlemen, if you've got any suggestions on that,
So there are certain improvements that a landlord is allowed to get increased rents for. Okay, what happens here now?
Okay, that's a subdivision of.
Well, sure. What's the impact on the other tenants? Does the landlord get to charge the other tenants because now he's done things for Section 8 that he no longer has?
All right, because
I got some prep stuff.
I got to go
to from
4 o'clock. Okay.
What about when the Section 8 tenant leaves?
Could you hold off for a second? We got to take a vote before legislators.
I got to go open.
What's the vote?
Okay. You want to vote yes?
I need appointments.
Yeah, we need a vote on John Hemmendinger and.
You got it.
And who else?
Herman Geist.
And the third one, Emmeline Rocha Sinha.
So moved.
And Vito Fisnick.
Another second.
So moved.
All in favor? Aye.
These are Healthcare Corporation Board.
Yes, they are. Yeah, Healthcare Corporation Board.
Yeah. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? And do I have a motion to confer upon our former colleague, the eminent Vito Pinto?
So moved.
Absolutely.
Do you have a second? All in favor?
Aye. Yes.
On discussion?
Please pass those around.
Yes.
Stop it.
Okay. Yes.
Let's make sure we got these questions.
Yes.
These questions right.
All right, let's sit down afterwards.
Do I have a motion? Okay.
Motion to adjourn.
I have another assignment for you, for the county attorney. Take a look at the penalty provisions and whether we can modify them just for the source of income.
Or we could decide that we want to change that civil penalty for the entire world.
But I wouldn't do that.
Now I'm taking an obligation to continue.
Okay. So let's get to... Okay, we're adjourned.
So we're adjourned.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Darcy? We're signing.
John, let's sit down the three of us.
Let's work out these questions. Okay. And why don't you guys come up?
You know what I'm saying? Most of the
yes, sir.
Things that are required by Section 8 are not building wide. That's what the problem is.
What?
Most of the improvements required by Section 8 are not
building wide.
But here's
a
different
take on
what you said, because I don't think what you're saying is a real issue. Here's an interesting question.
You're going to be around?
No, I got to go home.
The landlord does exactly that, makes major capital improvements to the entire building.
Only to get
by
right.
He's allowed to pass
make it
off.
Reality.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
But
I have
a money, it's
going to be pretty strong.
How does it impact that Section 8 tenant? Does that Section 8 allow major capital improvements?
Interesting reach in those constituents.
What happens with the